Now entering Nerdist.com.
When I actually pay attention to what's on my table, I look at all the stuff I learned. CB2, I could be getting some inexpensive modernist furniture.
You could be getting some. You could be getting some of Crate and Barrel's alternative.
I don't
line.
Think CB2 yeah. is so inexpensive, actually.
I thought it was supposed to be for the hip young among us, and
it
priced
is,
accordingly.
But I think it's expensive.
Are we recording, yeah, Matthew?
We are.
How does some it sound?
Good.
We sound okay.
Yeah. For breakfast, I had coffee. We done.
Yeah, that's good. That was a good mic check. Well, that's all we needed. We're just going around and getting mic checks from people, so we set up for a half hour.
Cool.
And say,
how do I sound?
That was awesome.
Yeah.
You guys are great.
Sound
just
good.
Make it simple and clean.
I mean, this is tight.
I am here with Damien and Tim of OK Go, and I guess they are also here with me and Matt and Jonah.
You guess, or
is
are
that
we,
the, is this
are you
the
sure?
transitivity
are you not sure
of here with?
Yeah, this is us gliding softly into the actual podcast, where I'm hunched over on the floor. Thank you for having us in your home.
You know, we could, if you want, we can go to the dinner table. We can all sit up for real.
It's too late.
I kind of like this.
You like this? I'm fine with this too.
Fireside chat.
Yeah.
I'm fine with this
fireside
as well.
Fireside chat.
Minus the fire.
Let me zip up my hipster zippers on my jeans, which I thought were an awesome idea.
Wait, do you have zippers on the back of your jeans?
Yeah, that's right. That's I keep my things tucked neatly in my pockets.
Wow.
So it thwarts pickpocketers and street urchins.
You're not supposed to sit on a wallet, though. I hope you're not doing that.
No, the wallet's right here. All right.
Good.
Yeah, I'm all up. I'm all into that.
Why aren't you supposed to sit on a wallet?
Ergonomics, dude. Get into it.
Yeah. I guess I should.
It's like wearing one high heel.
Yeah.
Okay, so wait, what's wrong with that?
Yeah, there we go.
Nothing as far as I'm concerned.
It's
but
slightly less foxy.
Back.
That's the problem.
Only
if you're going to do that, you might as well just go for the heel.
If you want to see people on one heel, you need to go down to Santa Monica and like Lexington and Highland, like right over there. That's where I had an office over there, and that's where the tranny hookers hang out. But they're not just. I feel like it's a sub fetish because they all look super beaten up, like ripped hose, one heel. Mm-hmm. Like clothing.
You have to be very specific when you're talking about trannies and you use the word hose.
Yeah.
You can't
just
say ripped hose because that could mean...
That could mean a lot of different things.
But speaking of trannies, I was recently in Long Island and saw a transmission service called Tranny Man.
That's genius.
Oh, I think someone was talking about that.
Yeah. And I stopped in their parking lot and took a picture of it, and they seemed pissed off. And it's like, well, I mean, you got to know that. I mean, either you don't get the joke and you're crazy, or you do, and that's why you kept the
or you think they're just bothered by it? You know, at this point, so many people come in to take pictures of the tranny man.
I guess so.
I caught the end of a HBO special last night about transgender sports writers.
Is that more than a person?
Yeah, that's a long special, I would imagine.
Transvestites are a lot like Netflix subgenres, where it just gets very, very detailed for no reason.
Do you like vampire mysteries set in the 70s? Oh, I guess I do, Netflix.
Click.
Wait, I want to hear more about who was this group of people.
Well, like I said, I came in at the end, but there were two women who used to be men.
Mm-hmm.
And... who were sports writers as men and continue to be sports writers as women. And it seems like the report was about how they get treated as women versus
Was it Real Sports with Brian Gumbel?
Yes, it was Real Sports with Brian Gumbel.
He's always hard-hitting.
Is that, is Real Sports like Real Sex?
You know, less titties.
Yeah.
Well, somehow more interesting and less gross
than
Real Sex.
Real sex is hard to get through, and it's not, I mean, it's like, you know, sex is something we all have pretty earnest interest in, I think.
I would definitely say I think it's cool.
It's hard to make sex unsexy, but they managed to do it.
You know, because when you're younger and you think, real sex, yay, and then they define, like, real sex as a bunch of old hippies sitting in a forest trying to telepathically make each other orgasm, like, it's not, it's horrible.
Yeah. That was Real Sex 16.
Oh, Matt, you really seem to know a lot about the Real Sex back catalog.
I had HBO when I was a kid. It was good.
I was really excited to have you guys on. You guys did Attack of the Show, I don't know, a month ago or so.
Ho-ha, ho-ha,
ho-ha. And I read your op-ed piece in the New York Times, and it was I tweeted the shit out of it. And people, I mean, you never know what people are going to respond to on Twitter and retweet, but it was one of the most retweeted things that I've ever posted because people were so floored.
Are you saying that shit is all blowed up?
I think that shit is all blowed up and ready to take on a trip somewhere to Awesome Town, because it was a phenomenally written piece.
Thank you very much.
And I also, I mean, I think every facet of the entertainment industry is sort of suffering from the short-sightedness of corporations who are trying to meet the bottom line. And but if anything good came out of it, it's that you guys have, it's kind of forced you to make some super awesome, innovative videos that people love.
Well, you know, I think that there's sort of two ways to look at the dissolution of the sort of, you know, standard music industry. And one is that there's that the structures that people got paid by are all, you know, shrinking or disappearing or imploding. And that makes it scary for, you know, money people as well as musicians. Like, you don't really know there's no like set way to go about doing it. Mm-hmm. And not that it was ever easy to do, but at least you, at one point, it was sort of like you play club shows until you get a deal, and then they give you a bunch of money to make a record, and they promote you for a while. And like, there's a sort of, you know, there's a way up the ladder, and not
especially
everybody.
Especially super scary for young musicians.
Yeah, and now there just isn't that system. Like, there's no set way to do it because that system has imploded. The good thing about that is that with the dissolution of the you know, the mode of distribution, you also have the dissolution of all of the sort of categories and creative barriers that were sort of built into it, or rather that kind of the types of creativity that grew to flourish in that system. Mm-hmm. Basically, I mean, if you think about music videos in particular, music videos in 1985 were advertisements and only advertisements. And in fact, you know, same in 1995 and pretty much the same in 2005. Which is that they were something paid for by record labels to sell the CDs.
Are you saying that The Reflex by Duran Duran was not just an artistic vision on part of Simon LeBron?
Just an advertisement, man.
What? Yeah. Why are you blowing my fucking Duran Duran dreams? God damn it, I love that song so much.
It's so good. Well, the thing is, they didn't make the music any worse, and in fact, it didn't make the videos necessarily worse. It's just that when you saw a video in 1994, the artist in that video was pretty much akin to a Toyota in a Toyota commercial. You know?
Right.
Like, it looks really cool, and it makes you, you know, want to invest in the idea of that artist, but it's not necessarily made by that artist, nor does it really have anything to do with the sort of creative ideas of that artist. And I mean, there were lots of musicians who took a great role in, you know, making their videos, and certainly it's, I mean, the Toyota thing takes a little far. But the reason they had to be so specific and there was such a sort of narrow genre for it is because MTV played 50 or 100 things a year, or, I don't know, 200 or whatever it was. There was a very, you know, it's a very tight playlist. And if you're not, when that was the only outlet for videos, it's like a super harsh climate for things to evolve in. I mean, there's an arms race to be the most demographically suitable. You know what I mean? You have to, if you don't keep the eyes glued to the screen that will then go out and buy skating sneakers, you're off. And, you know?
Well, but the funny thing about that is that, because I hosted a show on MTV in the 90s, and we always used to get complaints from people who would say, how come you don't fucking play videos anymore? A, like, I program the goddamn station.
Right, right, exactly.
And B, if everyone thinks that if you're on a show, you're responsible for every decision that gets made.
Sure.
But you're just the face that gets to absorb the complaints.
What was your show?
It was called Singled Out. It was like a dating show.
Okay, all right.
And there were a lot of tits and references, veiled references to wieners. But anyway, when we were doing that show, people constantly complained that MTV didn't play enough videos. And the idea is like, hey, guess what? No one watches video shows anymore because the attention spans have gotten too short, and they're literally the lowest rated shows on television. So that's why they put programming on.
Yeah. And I mean, when there were videos played, obviously, you had to be this very, very specific thing to succeed. And if you weren't one of those things, you might as well not exist. I mean, making a video that wasn't going to get played on MTV was just a huge waste of money. and so no one made them. And you got this really specific form, which we now think of as a music video. It's got to be glamorous, and the people have to look sexy, and like, it has to be fast cut and Batman angles, and like everything that we think of as being a music video. But when the distribution system falls apart, you don't have those rules anymore. I mean, there's right. no reason why a music video should be any of those things. I mean, now you make something and there's other people out there who find it interesting, and that's the end of the cycle. I mean, that's like that's the full loop. You make something that's interesting, other people like it, and you're done.
Hey, remember when Thriller cost $1 million and everyone was like, $1 million on a video? And then, like, Mark Romanek was blowing through that in the 90s.
Twice a week.
Like change.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it just is this huge arms race for those few tiny spots. And so it got more and more and more specific. And now, you know, I mean, that's just one example of the way in which things get, there's just all these new creative spaces that open up because you don't have those rules anymore. So who's to say that music is as we see it right now? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, music in the 20s was a live performance, and music in the early 50s was a 7-inch record, and music in the 70s was an album, and music in the 80s was a music video, and music now is what, you know, whatever YouTube. You think it is. It's YouTube.
Here was all music in the 20s in my estimation.
Sarsaparilla in the summertime.
That was it. That was every song. Yeah. That was every song in the 1920s.
Well, and those are all the ones we have recordings of.
That was it. Yeah, I always think, you know, people complain and they go, oh, in the old days, music was so much better. Look at all the music from the old days. And you're like, no, there was always shitty art. It just didn't survive because it was shitty.
Yeah. You only remember the greatest hits.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and there's plenty of times when the greatest hits were simply picked by the people at the top. And so, there's like, there's a lot of great music from the 80s that doesn't get listened to anymore. And we still remember Bobby Brown, you know?
Yeah. Oh, can you forget Bobby Brown?
How could you?
Glass Tiger, anyone? Glass Tiger? Nope, just me.
That actually right. was the
I do what I want to do.
I prefer to think of the Ghostbusters 2 soundtrack.
Yes. Oh, man. I would prefer to forget that got made. So, what was it?
That was the one that a Huey Lewis sued over, right?
No, Huey Lewis sued Ray Parker Jr. over I Want a New Drug.
Oh, okay.
Because the Ghostbusters theme, they went to Huey Lewis and said, hey, will you write the Ghostbusters theme? And he was like, no. And they were like, hey, fuck you in the face. Hey, Ray Parker Jr., put some different lyrics on that song.
Nice.
They're literally.
I didn't know that.
It's like if you listen to Ghostbusters song. and I want a new drug, they're the same song.
Really?
Yep.
Ghostbusters is better.
Shit, that's but not true. As good as I Want a New Duck by Weird Al Yankovic.
That is where it
man,
took its
you,
side tangent.
Weird Al, we could make the entire rest of this thing about how great Weird Al is. And not yes. and I mean I was a fan as a kid. I'm actually more of a fan now.
Do you know Al?
Yeah.
As do I, and he is every bit as nice as you hope he would
he's
be.
A sweet, sweet
yeah, man. If yeah. not and so tuned in and paying attention. Like every time we put out a video, I get an email from him like 10 minutes later being like, love the new video, you guys are doing great work. Like He is paying more attention to what's going on in the world than anyone I know.
Yeah. And he's a guy that, I mean, the reason he's managed to corner the market for so long is because, you know, he's like, talk about someone who can adapt. You know, he released all those songs last summer and spent no more than a few $1,000s on each video and made a bunch of amazing videos.
He's got a good formula.
He does.
He really does. Yeah. You know, VH1 approached Al about doing a show called The Next Weird Al, like Find the Next Weird Al. And he was like, oh, we want you to do the show with us. And he was like, why would I help you find someone to replace me when I'm still doing this?
Yeah.
Thankfully, he turned that down.
Yeah, well, he's a wise man.
But you guys managed to, I mean, you know, how much can it really cost to, like, the treadmill video? How much does the treadmill video cost?
It's about $2 million.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't know where the money...
No,
see it in the treadmills.
Yeah, no, the whole thing was CG, obviously.
Yeah.
Effects
and wizards at ILM.
It was difficult to get Mark Romanek actually to not use his typical style.
Right.
Especially when Spike Jonze was involved like that.
Right.
You called in Michel Gondry just as a consulting position, right?
Sure, which was difficult for Oliver Stone to deal with because, I mean, they just don't get along very well, you know?
Yeah.
And to resurrect John Huston was just such a good move, I think, on your part.
Yeah. And George Lucas just walked off.
Yeah. Walked right out.
Yeah.
Get Quentin in there who adds the N-word into the video, and then you got to pull it out. So that was another $1.5 million.
Yeah.
Dollars.
Yeah. But you kept saying nice over and over again. We were like, don't use that word.
Please stop saying nice.
The video cost about $5,000, which all of which was spent on buying treadmills and then returning them. They wouldn't buy them back at full cost.
There was a restocking fee.
So we found a guy who nobody would rent treadmills, especially we made it in Orlando, Florida, where my sister lived at the time. And I don't know if you could even rent treadmills in LA. Probably with the film industry you could, but in LA, I mean in Orlando you certainly couldn't, because if you think about it, there's really no reason to have a temporary treadmill in your life.
To try it out and send it back.
Right. Or be like, there's one afternoon when I'm gonna get all my friends together and we're gonna just party on the treadmill.
I don't know. We got an alpaca on Attack of the Show the other day. I feel like it seems like a weird world where alpacas are easier to come by than a treadmill.
Well, I mean, first of all, try that in Florida. Right. And second, I mean, when you want an alpaca, you're likely to not want it later. I mean,
you can probably find anything you want here in LA.
Yeah. But seriously, there are lots of crazy things you just want for a moment, but a treadmill is like you're either getting in shape or you're not. You run a gym or you don't.
Or you hang clothes on it after a while.
So we did find one guy who specialized in buying used treadmills from gyms and selling them to lesser gyms.
He's the crazy Gideon of treadmills. My treadmills are crazy.
Well, it wasn't just treadmills. It was all you know. He stocked gyms with used gym equipment from nicer gyms. And so we bought 8 treadmills from him, and then and he agreed to buy them back from us if we didn't break them at, I think, 70% of the cost or something. So we in the end, it cost us $5,000 in that, and there were some dry cleaning bills because the clothes we were wearing got really super sweaty. And
I think we bought
a lot
erasers.
Of coffee.
Do you remember that? Because we had scoffed the bottoms of the treadmill, so we had to erase the scoffs off.
Yeah. there were a lot of... In an attempt to return them and get full price back, we had to do a little work. Hold back the big dog. Sorry, the door.
Is that a term for when you go out at night? Yeah. You're like, hey, hold back the big dog. Oh, Damien's in rare form again.
He's talking about me.
Oh, okay. the funny thing is now I feel like you could probably sell those treadmills for $5,000 a piece.
Oh, great. Go get
it. Oh, hey.
Hello, hi. New people.
All right.
There's new people.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
Hi, intern.
Oh, where do you go to school?
For the listener, she's wearing a USC sweatshirt, so Jonah hilariously asked her what school she went to. And she answered earnestly, which was very sweet of her.
We are actually equipped with a USC foam finger if anybody wants to celebrate you.
Wait for it.
Oh, celebrate you and all your worth.
Yeah.
Now, I went to UCLA, but I'm told we have some sort of rivalry that I never cared about, so I don't know how I'm supposed to feel about that. But
well, we just did it.
But darn you, other school person.
You know the TED conference? They have a miniature TED conference at USC every year called...
Oh, really?
TEDx USC. And we were invited to be there this year and can't be, so we just did a little video for them, but we had to wear little USC fingers, and we tried to make fun of your rivalry USC UCLA thing, but
they didn't want us to.
They were like, this is the TED conference, we are above that, and we were making fun of didn't work out.
The TED conference was apparently also above Sarah Silverman when she performed at a TED conference.
What'd she do?
Well, she just did her act.
Yeah.
Like what they hired her to do, or what they asked her. Actually, they didn't hire her. She worked for free.
Which is wonderfully offensive.
It is wonderfully offensive, and they had such like, how dare you? Like it was such a big fucking deal. But it's like, hey, that's Sarah. What do you think, TED conference?
What do you expect?
Well, I am a big fan of the TED conference. But
I too am a big fan of the TED. Those the TED Talks online,
those are great.
I did a panel with a person from YouTube and a person from the TED conference at South by Southwest just 2 weeks ago. And the panel title was hilariously, How to Make a Viral Video. Which like one part water, two parts rice.
You must love that question now because you guys have done it a few times, and so now I'm sure everyone's like, all right, what's the lab formula?
I was surprised actually that there were a few rules you could learn from at least the YouTube people who like really parse their numbers and figure shit out. One of them is that this seems obvious if you think about it, but then it doesn't, that positive stuff travels way more than negative stuff.
Uh-huh.
And you sort of think because getting
that's
kicked
surprising.
In... Yeah, I mean, yeah. You'd think that getting kicked in the balls is probably the most... That's the most viral
that's
thing
gonna
that could
get
be, right?
That's going to get the most clicks from me.
Yeah. But then, the truth is that, like, news works that way, but people don't want to be the bearer of bad news. So, like, if you want to send something to your friends, you want it to be something that makes them happy.
Really want to watch negative things over and over again.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right. But uplifting, you know, like wonder is a good drug, you know.
Well, I was so, you know, I was really excited from the standpoint of just going back to your article for a second that you guys were able to take the situation where EMI I mean, just in case people don't know, you should Google Damien and New York Times, and you can get the article. But
it's called Who's Tube. They're actually
Who's Tube, yeah.
I've written a bunch of op-eds for them, but that's the one that you speak of.
So you make the treadmill video. It gets 8 to 10 million views, which is, I mean, that's legendary status to get that high.
The treadmill video, it just passed 50.
Okay, well, but at one time it was at 8 or 10, right?
There so, was a time. I think sometime before.
Wait a second, I'm in my lost parallel life,
yeah,
and that's where it was 8 or 10.
Yeah, that was 2004.
So 50 million, even 5 times more of a shitload than. And then they say, hey, we're not going to let you make these videos embeddable anymore from now on. Was it literally just a bottom line thing? Did anyone tell you that that's what they were going to do, or are they just disabled?
I don't recall being told. If it was mentioned somewhere, I didn't hear it. They actually disabled the embedding feature a couple years ago while we were in the midst of well, we were the end of touring for our last album. We weren't really paying attention to the to that. We noticed it when we first started putting new videos online for our new album, mm-hmm. and noticing that it wasn't actually, the numbers don't matter a whole lot to us. It's mostly sort of the reaction from our fans and whether or not we sort of can tell that we are engaging with our fans the way we want to. Mm-hmm. And we were just flooded with complaints from our fans that either they couldn't see it because they lived in some country where YouTube, where it was blocked, or that it couldn't be on blogs, it couldn't be embedded.
And I feel like now we sort of have this approach to the internet of, if you can't get something on the internet, and you're like, what the fuck do you mean I can't see this on the internet? Like, we're so conditioned that we should get whatever we want whenever we want it that we get really mad.
Yeah, well, and I you know, there's that it is sort of silly, but it's also not sort of silly in the sense that you sort of feel like you can pick up the phone and call anyone, right? Mm-hmm. And the idea that, I mean, those common carriage laws that anything you do like from one point to the other point on the internet is just the same as anything else. We take that for granted in our phone system and in our internet, and it's, of course, that's not always true.
Well, so when I first saw This Too Shall Pass, I saw the second one first, and then the first one second, the one that EMI had disabled. And I loved how, just watching the second one that you made, the one that was embeddable, the tension in all of your faces was amazing. Because it was just like, oh my God, you know, you can see that they've already been hit by paint. Like, how many times? What was the number, 53?
Well, we only got to the paint a few times, actually. Because the paint, it's a Rube, you know, a 3-minute Rube Goldberg machine,
yep.
and the last thing the machine does is splatter us in the face with paint. And the reason we chose to do that is we wanted it to be clear that the thing was cycling. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you start with paint, you can't figure out why we're covered in paint, then you get to the end and you realize
it was like
why.
Memento.
Exactly.
You distracted me the whole time trying to figure out the paint.
So I think we got shot in the face in total 5 times, because each day we shot for 2 days, and each day we started by getting shot because we had it just in case we got it on the first take, we wanted to be covered in paint the whole time. And then we got to the end of the thing 3 times, so that was 3 more face splats.
So if you got to the end, what went so wrong that you had to do it again?
Oh, I mean, we just wanted to keep going. I mean, there's usually the little things that were wrong were camera would be looking at the wrong thing, and I strain to praise the man who did that Steadicam work enough.
Yeah, I was gonna ask, like, what was the setup of the camera? Like, how big was the rig? Is it just strapped?
It's a normal Steadicam rig, which is about 70 pounds or so. It's basically a big counterweighted arm, so that when you move, it kind of moves. It's hard for you to make it jostle, basically. And we have a HD video camera that goes on top of it. So he was he's doing like 16 hours a day of walking the machine over and over again with this 70-pound thing on him.
He was like a soldier dancing a ballet.
Yeah,
like, it was unbelievable. It was really crazy to watch.
And it was fun to talk to him too. He wears a specific kind of sneakers. He's like, some Steadicam guys go Puma. Some do that. I mean, like, they, but you have to, like, he feels, you know, it's like, it's, what's the, is it, no, who's got the P behind their back?
Oh, sorry, I thought you were talking about Dr. Octopus from Spider-Man.
No.
You went there pretty quickly.
No, it's just like, you know, like, it's attached to him. Sorry.
No, the fairy tale where the chick sleeps on the bed and she can feel the P under, like, 95 mattresses.
Princess and the P.
Princess and the Pea. I was going to say Rapunzel, but she's the one with the sweet
pea
hair.
Pea princess.
So yeah,
Dr.
so
Dr. Octopus.
He has to basically be able to do that. Like he has to, you know, like completely know everything about the ground he's walking on from just from sort of feeling it. Yeah, anyways, he was amazing, but there were a few times when we'd get through the machine and he'd barely miss some interaction, and you kind of got to see
at him?
All of it.
What the fuck, Pumas?
What the fuck are you doing?
Yeah. Maybe if you had the Pumas, you wouldn't have fucked that up. Yeah. Let's do this again.
And on the bottom floor, I go slamming through this pile of boxes, and the boxes go like fall everywhere. So we had to have people running in front of him, removing the boxes so that he could get through it.
Yeah.
And so occasionally you see, like in two of the three takes that we got, you see someone sort of duck through frames.
Who planned the machine?
It was designed by a group called Syn Labs, Syyn Labs.
Sexy.
And yeah, very sexy. Two Y's in there. Although I haven't figured out what they're for. Do you know what that means?
No, I don't know what that means.
I came up with a short brief. I wrote a two-paragraph job description, essentially. Posted it online looking for a good, inspiring and inspired nerds who could help us make exactly what got made. I thought that it would take one or two people 2 or 3 months. And the day after I posted it, I got a proposal from 15 people that was 25 pages long saying, we want to do it.
God.
And I was like, we can't afford 15 people. And they're like, yeah, but we really want to do it. And I was like, yeah, but we really can't afford it. And so they basically did it. They like split the money up between the 15 of them and they worked for, it wound up being in the end. I mean, it was 2.5 months of design and then 3 months of building. Jesus. And
it was like serious brain power.
Yeah, there was some really, it was a really interesting group of people because it was, you know, it started with a lot of engineers and computer science people and people who are prone to liking that, you know, like physics and toying around with stuff. But by the end we had, there was a pirate, rigger from a pirate, it wasn't a pirate ship, but a rigger from a long ship in the harbor, and he helped like do all the, you know, the zip line and all the rigging stuff in there.
Was he missing a piece of his shoulder where there was a treasure map tattooed
of course,
it?
Okay. Yeah. Right.
I remember at the end of the show, he was like, "So we'll see you next week for the party for the video." Yeah, and like, he was like, "No, I'll be sailing on the Black Sea or something."
Yeah, he's like, "I'll be in Indonesia, son."
Arr. I was like, "Okay."
I've got to haul the spices back to Malta.
The Jacob's Ladder thing at the end, the giant doors that fall down say this too shall pass, those were all painted by the guy who designed the new Coke bottle.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
Yeah, like, I mean, talk about somebody a little overqualified for the job. But basically what happened was we had gathered this group of, like, just awesome, exciting people, and it just sort of became, like, a magnet for more. And by the end, there were 60 people in there working, and, you know, I was where Adam Sadowski, who runs Syn Labs, and I had been working on the design back and forth, and we had a bunch of design meetings here in my house, and we sort of came up with a bunch of rules for what makes a good machine and what makes a bad machine, and where we wanted it to go up and down in the song in terms of sort of, you know, big things here, small things there, and colorful things here and nerdy things here, and slowly we got a basic sort of plan for the thing together, and then passed back and forth movie files while we were on tour, and they'd show us what was happening in the space and everything. And then 2 weeks before the video, we basically just moved in and worked with them like 24 hours a day. And it just, it went from being like 10 people on average there to by the end, 60 people plus film crew. And it was just
a lot of them had day jobs, you know? So like during the afternoon, there was sort of like a skeleton crew, but if you showed up around 8 o'clock, I mean, there'd be like 60.
But that's what the best, that's the best thing about nerd sourcing is that you're talking about a demographic of people that have tremendous honor with what they do, and whenever they think something is special, they will work for free as long as it takes just so they can be a part of the special thing. And I would imagine that at this point, you probably have armies of, like, you're probably set for every video you ever want to make again.
Well,
because
if they're
they
good
always
ideas.
Turn out super awesome.
Yeah. You know, I mean, one thing we keep getting asked is like, why didn't you fake it? There's all these parts in there you could have faked.
No, you can't. You got
to
do
but
it.
But the thing is, none of those people would have worked it, and we all wanted to make something impossible. And if we were like, okay, army of nerds, we're gonna, like, this is actually all just a lie. Like, it just would have walked out. You know what I mean, like,
did it break any records?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's number one most awesome thing.
Yeah. Guinness Book of World Awesome Things.
That's right.
According to my dad.
Yeah. So it's that video and then the two fat guys on the mopeds for Guinness Book of Awesome Things.
Yeah, now I don't know if it, but I to my knowledge, there aren't, I've never seen another Rube Goldberg machine that actually hits, that is timed, that hits beats.
Exactly.
Like that.
That's what was like my favorite part about it, just so specific to the song in each part. Like it really did feel like it was just like another instrument, you know.
That was definitely the biggest design challenge for them, and they, you know, they grumbled a lot. I mean, rightfully
so. Why can't
it
just explode here and then knock over the things?
Well, you know, one of the things that we discovered a lot of things you just wouldn't have guessed in advance. I mean, first of all, it's really super hard to define what makes a good Rube Goldberg machine.
Dominoes.
Well, I mean, it has to look like it shouldn't work, basically. You know, like, and so good engineers, and I mean, several of the people there actually work at Jet Propulsion Labs and NASA. So, there's people who literally could have put us on the moon, probably. Literally, probably.
It had to be figuratively literal.
And asking them to make something that doesn't work every time and is precarious and just barely hits it, that's just bad design.
It's a bit painful for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's just in an engineer's DNA to make something that's robust and works every time, and that's just not an interesting Rube Goldberg machine.
I would love to see a Rube Goldberg machine that go to Mars. Like some series of cause and effect machines that end on the Martian landscape.
Dominoes all the way to a button that launches a rocket to Mars. Boom.
No, done. But that's too fast of a machine. It'd have to...
Long string of dominoes.
It'd have to hit a cat that ran into a shark, and then the shark would poop that out, and that would float into a boat, and then the boat would explode.
It's a month-long Rube Goldberg.
Eons long. It could just actually be the Rube Goldberg machine eventually gets humanity to be really super greedy and use up all our resources, and we have to move it.
A social Rube Goldberg.
Yeah. What if we are the Rube Goldberg machine, guys?
Leak, brain bleeding
out
of
head. Wait, do you guys do sound effects in the show? Because now is a good time for a lot of delay. And like space effects.
Where are we?
You know, Tom Lennon brought a slide whistle on the show.
Really?
So we did have a slide whistle on the first episode.
People keep on asking for it to come
back.
We
have some cool noise makers back in the studio. You want to bring some stuff out?
I think we might have to.
Yeah, I think the answer is always
jam session at the end?
Yeah. Do you guys know Bleep Labs? They make these little, well, we got it. Ariel, are you here?
Are you a medium?
Tim is more interesting than me anyways. Give him 2 minutes.
Where are you going?
Damien's going back to get the noisemakers.
Is the studio open?
No, it's locked up again. I feel like Garth in Wayne's World right now.
I don't know what to say. All right, he's gone, Tim. Give us the dirt. He sucks,
change.
Right?
What? So seriously, what's going on?
You ever see that part in Scanners where the dude's head?
Damien won't let me talk.
Oh my God, you guys, I think Tim needs help.
It's weird. We're in Damien's living room, but we're not really in Damien's living room.
The thing you have to remember is that there is no spoon.
That was in a film called The Matrix.
What's that?
Matrix. It was.
You know, I never saw The Matrix.
You didn't?
I never saw The Matrix.
No reason to.
My favorite.
Really?
Wait a minute.
Like as far as like a cultural.
I never saw The Matrix.
I know it. And I haven't seen Avatar either.
Well, here's
once again, no point.
What was the first one you didn't see?
You've never seen The Matrix.
Oh. I've never seen The Matrix.
I think I have it.
Really?
Yeah.
Maybe I ought to see it.
Okay, so here's one that I made.
Now that looks like a tricorder.
The light doesn't work anymore. Wait, maybe it does.
Well, I can't appreciate that without a light.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
That's awesome. Nice. You made that? You made that machine?
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't design the circuits in it, but I did. But yes.
Now, were you a kid that went to Radio Shack and bought like build your own radio type of stuff? Or
yeah.
Run a robot
on
a wet potato?
Mostly Legos. I was really super into Legos.
I see some awesome Lego stuff around here.
Did you see my Taj Mahal over there?
Your Taj
Holy
Mahal
shit.
Is awesome.
I didn't know that was a Lego.
Yeah. That's a kit. You can buy. I have been berated by more serious Lego artists. Yes. Somebody actually came to one of our shows recently and was like, they had seen something in a magazine article in which I'd said, like, I really like Legos. I'm working on the Taj Mahal. And they're like, the Taj Mahal is a kit. You can buy that from Lego. That's not art.
Oh, because they felt you weren't a purist. Because you, yeah.
Someone today posted a Yosemite Sam made out of Lego blocks.
Really?
Not a kit, but yeah.
Well, I used to do a show for Nickelodeon, and someone just sent in. They built like a 3.5-foot-high SpongeBob, made out of Legos.
Really? Well, that's amazing.
Oh, that's rad.
That's the sting for that's amazing.
Oh,
that's
rad.
Gorgeous.
Chris, you should get a video of that and put it on as a accompaniment.
This is pleasant for you to listen to, podcasters. I hope you're enjoying yourself.
Yeah, I like this podcast, but it just doesn't have enough random electronic noises. No, wait. I just want to get some video of that
so people can see.
So
for our audio listeners, what this is a little box that is decorated to look like a little robot, and it makes sounds. It has an optical sensor on the front of it, and the pitch is modulated by what that optical sensor is seeing. It also has a little LED antenna, so it's sort of like a feedback loop. It can just see the light in the room. Like right now, my thumb's over it, so it sees almost nothing. And then as I open it up, you start to hear stuff. The frequency of the bursts is controllable by a little knob. And then if I stick the LED light into the nose, which is the optical sensor, blam! Blam!
That's unbelievable.
What
I feel
video
like
game does
I feel
that
like you
like?
Could have explained that in a Professor Frink voice.
Oh,
the light is modulated. The sensors.
And the secret ingredient.
You want to do it again? I mean, you'll do the you'll do the talking.
No, but I do want to get a close up picture of it because it's a gorgeous machine.
It's made by a company called Bleep Labs.
That little guy shows up on our record a lot.
A lot. Yeah, this is on our record all over the place.
It looks a little like I have an app on my phone called Bebot. Just a little trackpad synthesizer.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah,
but that's this analog.
This is also the primary instrument in our new Muppets song. We covered the Muppets theme for a Muppets covers album that's coming out
next month.
Yeah.
We're
going to try to make a video with the Muppets.
Dig it.
My friends are making all those new Muppet videos right now.
Are those your friends? And I'm meeting with them tomorrow. No,
those are fantastic.
Friday morning. But yeah, the new Muppets videos are splam-tastical. They're redonkulous.
It's amazing. It's, you know, these guys basically approached Disney and they were like, please let us, please just let us make some sketches that were akin to the voice of the old Muppet show. And it was like, what? What do you want to do? And they're like, exactly. And that blew their fucking mind, like that little robot. And
wait, are they the ones that did the Bohemian Rhapsody?
They did Bohemian Rhapsody.
That is awesome. Like the best thing that's been made in
about
400 years.
And what's amazing for me is that they always send it to me. I'm not trying to brag, but I'm going to brag about something that I don't know what the value is. But they will send it to me. They send me the videos the second they go up. So I get to blog them first. And that gives me a huge nerd boner. Bohemian Rhapsody had 300 views when I put it up.
Wow.
And
God, it's like up to almost 500 now, isn't it?
It's at least 502.
Wow.
Which is really amazing.
Amazing.
Which is really amazing. So I'm not saying I have helped reinvent the Muppets.
I hope that's the people we are meeting with. We basically made this Muppet song and just then we called them. We're like, obviously we're the band that makes videos and you have Muppets. So it's kind of like the Reese's peanut butter cup thing, chocolate and your peanut butter together. Let's make a
chocolate baby
song. Or did they assign you the Muppets?
They had a list of songs and it had to be obviously a Muppet song.
Yeah.
And all the best ones were already taken, and then
including
the theme, which we eventually got, and the band that was doing the theme like ran out of time or decided they didn't want to do it. I don't know. I mean,
didn't have enough time to.
I don't want to say the name of the band,
it's time to play the music, and then go into some sort of weird 6/8 time.
I love the Muppets so much. I mean, I can be pretty cool. Like I can play it pretty cool when meeting idols and I'll tell you about a week of my life I think this is October. We got to be the Pixies behind Frank Black at a concert.
Holy shit.
Exactly. Holy shit. I mean, the Doolittle's probably the most important record of my life. Maybe besides Purple Rain, but it's a really, really big deal for me. And we went and had band practice with Frank Black, Black Francis, Charles Thompson, and I was totally cool. I was like, I was excited, but kept my cool and everything. And right after practice, we got done just in time for me to go to see a friend of mine was going to be on the Leno show that evening. Mm-hmm. So I went to go just like, sit backstage and watch it happen, cheerlead. And I got there, and keep in mind, I've just met my number one idol in my life and been totally cool about it.
Keeping in mind.
the Muppets were the Muppets had their own dressing room, and I got and like and I got to hang out with Kermit, and I fucking lost it. Like I there's this video of me online where I look like I'm both high and crying, and it's essentially because I basically was like that's the effect Kermit has on me. Wow. Is I suddenly am high and crying.
And I hear that when you, I've never actually met the Muppets in person. But
in felt,
yes. I've never met the Muppets in felt, but I hear that you talk to them like they're people, and the operators are, you know, like,
it's you don't even really notice the dude there because they're the movement.
That's how he gets your wallet.
Yeah, there's so, I mean, you're at least for those of us who spent hours and hours and hours and hours of our lives watching the Muppets, their mannerisms are so ingrained that when they're done right, it doesn't seem like a puppet at all. You know, yeah. It's like a
Did you ever see the DVD extras on the Muppet movie?
No.
There are these DVD extras on the Muppet movie where it's Jim Henson and Frank Oz going out to do field tests before they shoot the Muppet movie.
Wow.
Just to see what the Muppets look like in real environments. Uh-huh. But the whole time they're just fucking with each other and cracking each other up. So, you know, you'll see it's Kermit and Fozzie there on the tree, and then and he's like, ah, bear in his natural habitat, and then Kermit's like, ah, Fozzie, you're not a real bear. And he's like, what are you talking about? How many bears, you know, have a magenta nose? And then they start cracking up and you see the puppets start shaking. So it's just like, that's it's awesome. Just like 5 or 10 minutes of them fucking with each other.
Wow, I gotta see that.
Out in the wild.
Nice Kermit the Frog, by the way.
Oh,
that
thanks.
That was a good Kermit.
Everyone's got a good Kermit though, right?
No, yours was really good.
Oh, you guys. Also, the Silent Movie Theater in LA showed a limited edition run of these films that the Jim Henson Estate
very quietly
had given them. Very quietly. Where's the sound? It says fucking silent. Carry on.
Wow. I would. when did they do that, and will they do it again?
I don't know if they'll do it again. They did it last year, and they showed all these old Muppet archive stuff that you can't see anywhere. Like they showed, they pitched the Muppet Show to a couple different networks a couple times before it got sold, and the pitches were fucking genius. And then all the commercials that Jim Henson did and everything, and it was.
Wow.
To just watch like how far ahead of the game that guy was.
He
was
is
mind blowing.
Yeah, it's like. You know when they're like this, back to the viral video thing, it's that sense of like total wonder where you go like, I love humanity, like
yeah.
Everything Jim Henson did. I just said Hanson, but I meant Henson. I was thinking of the Hanson twins at the same time.
Jim Henson was a prick, but Jim Henson is awesome.
Wait, they're not twins, the Hansons. There's three of them, aren't there?
The Hansons? They're
yeah.
not twins.
No. Jim Henson, everything he did gives you that feeling of like. The humanity is great and is capable of so much wonderful stuff.
Jonah
you know?
Can't really talk about Jim Henson's death without getting a little choked up because the story's super sad.
Yeah, the story's really fucking bums me out.
Isn't there? There's a film I think being made about his life called The Muppet Man. I think have you heard about this?
No, but I hope that's true.
And I think it's like both the Muppet like an the Muppets as like I think sort of parallel his life. And mm-hmm. so it sort of goes back and forth between his life, and then it goes to the Muppets like several years later when they're much older.
That
I
sounds
guess.
Awesome.
Wow. And apparently it's supposed to, and I guess it like parallels.
Well, if I only have season one on DVD, and there are several seasons after that now available, but. The Muppets I know from my youth were later seasons. I don't know if it was 5 or 6 or whatever, but like I remember them from the late 70s and early 80s. And season one is like it is a pretty different cast actually.
Yeah.
Like what there's no Miss Piggy basically. Like she's not a character at all yet.
Yeah.
And there's no pigs in space or anything. I mean, there's like it's a whole different thing, and it does definitely grow and evolve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a weird thing too. If you read the Live from New York, the Saturday Night Live book, the oral history of it.
Yes.
Mike O'Donohue, is that his name?
Yeah,
Mike O'Donohue, like, hated the Muppets.
What?
It would always make me so angry reading it, because, like, he was the one forced to write the Muppet bits for each Saturday Night Live,
yeah.
as it were, and he was getting fed up trying, because he was always the guy that tried to do the weirdest stuff, the most avant-garde, and so he, at his desk, apparently had a Kermit the Frog in a noose. Just hanging there. And I remember reading it, and like I kind of understood as like, you know, a comedy writer, like being forced to kind of do the stuff you don't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But then also like just like I was get pissed off at him. I was like, fuck him.
Well,
he gets the right
that's
for
so,
Kermit.
That's so atypical from Saturday Night Live, what seems to be a completely toxic and unfortunate experience for everyone
from
involved.
Day one, yeah.
But I did love back when SNL would have the Muppets on, or they would have
Candace Bergen,
or Joel. Mm-hmm. When Joel Hodgson, are you a Joel Hodgson fan at all?
I don't even.
Mystery Science Theater.
Yeah.
Joel Hodgson used to go on with these. That's why the only reason I thought of it is because of the Rube Goldberg stuff. But he used to make these insane contraptions that he would go on with.
Yeah.
And
he was like a prop comic.
Yeah.
And yeah.
A promic. Yep.
Yes. And he would, he actually like that's how Mr. Science Theater kind of got born, because out of like all the different, like the whole, you know, invention exchange that would happen in every episode, mm-hmm. or to facilitate all of his props that he made through his comedy. Uh-huh. But like, it was awesome.
So I'm sure someone from the Henson Estate will send you these videos if you want them, because I'm sure they're fans of yours.
If that's true,
I'll tell you something. I live up the street from Brian Henson,
uh-huh.
and the next time I see him out when I'm walking my dog, I will say, do you know the band OK Go? And I'm sure he will say, yes, I do, and I'll see if I can facilitate. Even though they don't, well, actually, no, that's the Henson Estate stuff. It's not Disney, so I think it's all his private stuff.
That would be a major dream come true.
That would be a major, major dream come
true. We'll screen it in your home theater.
Yeah, I do have, sometimes I set up a screen here. This is also not good for our audio listeners, but
right there, huh?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah,
that's amazing. I've never seen there.
Oh shit!
Where did you get that object?
What we do is we watch Blue Planet and Planet Earth,
because
you can't really watch those on just a TV. That has to be projected.
We also watch R. Kelly.
Oh, and R. Kelly. Yeah, I mean, you know,
the closet or just random
out of the closet.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, we usually try to stick to the first 12 episodes. The other ones will come out if we're really good and drunk. But it's
totally jumped the shark after 12.
Yeah.
So what do you guys? Is there anything you're working on now that you're particularly excited about?
Yeah, there's a lot we're working on right now that we're particularly excited
about.
Can
I just stop you and interrupt you, even though I just asked you a question? But my favorite thing about you guys is that you're super nice, incredibly talented, and I think this is just a lesson for anyone who makes stuff. You genuinely love what you do, and that is the most important thing that you should be doing. That you should do this stuff because it's
fun.
Truth.
Kapow!
Truth. Wait, but do you interview a lot of people who don't love what they do?
Well, I'm a comic, and a lot of comics.
Oh, well, comics hate what they do, but that's the whole point.
Right? I love it though, and there's a common misconception that as a comic you kind of have to be cranky and
dark
miserable
and fucked up, yeah.
But I know a lot of comics that are super cool. But yeah, but some people forget.
But are they any good?
Yes, they are actually. Yeah. I do know some fun loving, super funny people. But in general, that's a common misconception that you have to be dark and tortured in order to make art. And you know, I love seeing guys like you that are fun and cool and nice, and as a result, make good, fun, cool, nice stuff.
Thank you.
And I think that's part of why your fans connect with you so much, because they really. They are able to absorb that when they're watching you.
We do feel a lot like our fans, in the sense that, I mean, we did not come to music being virtuosic players or people who knew every jazz musician ever and could mm-hmm. tell you about the history of music. We're just fans, you know. We're just people who like listen to music all the time. I grew up in DC, where there was a really great punk rock scene, and I was at a show every night of the week for 4 years of my life, and it's just. It was like sort of what we lived and breathed, and back then, you know, that was in the 90s, and all I could do was really collect 7 inches and go up to people after shows and be like, man, you're the greatest thing ever. But now there's the community we can have with our fans is so much more robust and so much more interesting, and it, you know, when we do these projects and then we ask our fans to do like to engage with them in different ways, and or, you know, we just started We did this Rube Goldberg machine for This Too Shall Pass, and we've asked our fans to start making Rube Goldberg machines themselves. And so every day, starting, I think this Friday, or is it next week?
I think it's next week.
Either this Friday or next Friday, we are going to start picking the best one out there, and whoever, whatever the best one that day is, can pick tickets to any of our shows in the future.
Oh, that's awesome.
And, it's actually, you think about it from our perspective, it's just like one pair of tickets to a show. It doesn't mean anything. I mean, it does mean something, but it's not.
I know what you mean.
It's not like, it doesn't cost us anything. And our fans, you know, we've already started getting tons of submissions of people just doing cool, creative things. And that's exactly what sort of brought me and Tim together in the first place, is that since we met at age 12, and since then we've always been making these crazy projects together. Some of them music, some of them videos, and some of them, you know, just art projects of various kinds. And to know that we can sort of engage in a larger way with a whole wider fan base of people who are sort of like that. I mean, you can sense from our fans a sort of itchy, creative, like I just want to make shit feeling, and it's just so fun. I mean,
speaking of which, Did you get the interview remix that I sent you?
Yes.
Did you like it?
I love it. I got a call at 4 o'clock in the morning and woke up and then was like couldn't quite get myself back to bed. So I listened to it like half asleep at 4 a.m. and I was like, when I woke up in the morning, I wasn't sure if I had.
What is it?
You should play it. You should play it.
Yeah. Okay. I made a recording. We were getting interviewed in Japan, and there was a guy who just was asking really amazing questions.
Yeah, he says like, your new record has a funky vibe about it.
Yeah, it's kind of real.
I sounded Italian.
And you remixed it?
And yeah, so I recorded it.
Is it on your phone?
Well, wait.
Not on my phone.
Would you do would you do me a favor? Rather than playing it right now, what if, can you send me the file and I'll just end the whole thing with it? Because obviously, you know, I'm sure people are going to ask, oh, are you guys going to play a song? They're not going to play a song right now. The whole band's not here. We're just sitting around talking. That would be a great way to end the podcast.
Yeah. Play that. So there's one line from the interview that I really loved, and we talked about it right after the interview, and I was just kind of going through my phone, you know, listening to the recordings, and I found the interview, and so I kind of cut it up and put a little beat under it.
It's really good. Tim has gotten really good, actually, at making things only in his iPhone. Tim made a song recently called Showy Time, which is about what that is time to take a shower.
Right. And Showy Time.
Showy time. Yeah.
Showy time.
Can we play that too? Or is that for Tim's private collection?
This one's probably private collection material. But it's all done with it. What's the name of the app that you use for it?
It's called IMT Pain.
IMT Pain. Yeah.
I got a good rendition of In Love with a Stripper on my iPhone.
Right. I can't remember what beat I used. I don't think it's I'm in Love with a Stripper, though.
But so he made this great version and then recorded a video for it on his iPhone also.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
It's really good.
Now, I'm a little bit older than you, but I just remember.
How do you know?
I'm pretty sure. Because you said you grew up in the 90s.
Yeah. Right? Well, no, I just was in my teens in the 90s, but I was in my teens for 200 years.
Oh, when I was born to darkness, as I call it.
He's Richard.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And I'm surrounded by technology all the time. I'm a huge technophile, and yet I still try to transport myself back to 12-year-old me in the early 80s, just with like an Atari 2600, and just trying to see if I can imagine my mind exploding if I were to say, someday you will get a communication device.
Right.
That you can watch movies on and make
someday
things on. Yeah.
This thing will do porn.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because I was just starting to get into that then, and 8-bit porn was terrible back then.
It was awful.
It was just bad. Like,
I like it. Use your imagination more.
It was just like blockhead characters trying to fuck other blocks with lines. And like, I can't masturbate to that more than 6 times, and then you're done. But 8-bit porn, someone's got to make 8-bit porn.
I'm sure it's been made.
I'm sure it exists, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it has to.
Yeah. Remember,
I know there's ASCII porn. There must be 8-bit porn.
I remember growing up, me and my friends would pause Street Fighter 2. Not that that's 8-bit, that's 16-bit, but we would pause when Chun-Li was doing her upside-down helicopter kick.
And try to look up her digital skirt?
You don't have to try. It's all there.
Really? They put
Whoa.
It in there?
Yeah, guys.
Are you serious?
Yeah. No, she's wearing panties.
Oh, even hotter.
Yeah,
it's leaves something in the imagination.
The lengths that kids will go.
You could see, what was her name?
Chun-Li.
You see Chun-Li's bologna muffin?
Oh, God. Wow, this really took a turn for the morning
show. To be
show.
Fair, I thought of that 5 hours ago, and I'm like, I can't wait to drop that into a conversation. I don't want you to think that I'm...
That's always sitting
that
there.
I'm some kind of
up.
Vaginal wordsmith.
What was the ham one you came up with recently?
Oh, I don't remember. I don't remember.
Like ham suitcase. I can't remember what it was.
Ham suitcase.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
God. Smile.
No.
Duffel bag might be more.
This has gone way south. I apologize.
Yeah. Okay. We'll bring it back. You were talking about how you thought of yourself as a 12-year-old, you know, with lesser technology and wondering about the future. I often think about it the other way. There's technology is now so. So infinite. There's so much more stuff out there that to be played with than you could possibly ever play with, and to figure out. Things are moving so much faster than you could possibly like keep up with everything. That it seems to have made something of a total meritocracy for ideas, because you just can't. There's nothing about being the first one to use a technology matters at all anymore. It's just about being like using it well, and so. Good, really good, simple ideas that just everybody attaches to, it really sort of strangely points you back at the humans, because it just doesn't matter if you're the first person to do some like crazy thing with.
And
a
that's
new
an
website,
interesting element to your videos is that they're all wonderful analog achievements. You know, when, just like you said, when they're like, oh, why don't you just shortcut this thing? You're like, you know, people really appreciate that now. And that's why, you know, with I think people worry about CG killing the special effects industry. And I always feel like, you know, there's always going to be a place for someone who really understands the craft of the physical universe.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the fun things that that I think, if people were to say, how do you make a viral video? Do something really special that someone couldn't ordinarily do, you know, that looks like you put some effort into it.
Yeah.
I know a lot of hipsters hate effort, but I think some people appreciate it.
I mean, that panel, actually, we wound up sort of saying that the best way to really try to get there is just to think of something impossible and then try to do it. Yeah. And probably you will fail, but if you actually just like spend a ridiculous amount of time trying to do something impossible and you get pretty close, people will want to see it.
Mm-hmm. You know why the house always has the blackjack advantage, you guys? Because they have to keep drawing to 17. They don't have a choice. So they're going to win, you know, the majority of the times because they have to keep trying. That's my blackjack analogy.
Wow.
P.S. I hate Vegas, and I don't really play blackjack very often, so I didn't want to think I'm Blackjack Hardwick, who just has to make everything about cards.
I thought that. Thank you.
Would you do me a favor and unthink that?
Done.
Matt Meyer in your NASA shirt?
Yep. Glows in the dark, too. I don't.
That glows in the dark?
Yeah, it does.
Wow. That's cool.
Let's turn off all the lights, you guys.
We were looking for shirts. We just made a video that requires great stretches in time, and we were looking for shirts that had digital clocks on them. And we found them, but I couldn't tell from the website whether or not they would show up in sunlight. Do you think that there are digital clock T-shirts that show up in sunlight yet?
It's hard because are they LCD or LED?
No, neither. They're like hype tech D.
Oh, I don't know then. Did you go to thinkgeek.com?
No, they're like some kind of there's some kind of flexible material that kind of lights up. I mean, you ever seen those T-shirts that have the fake equalizer on them?
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, that's not, maybe that's LEDs in there, but I think
there's a cart that sells that at the Grove, and I don't remember
the guy there. The guy there selling it could probably explain this to us.
Go to the kiosk at the Grove. He'll know.
He'll know.
There you'll meet an old man. He'll have three riddles to solve.
I bought one of those T-shirts at 2 a.m. outside of Malo, the restaurant.
Yeah.
At sunset.
Wait, was a guy selling it on the street?
There was a guy selling them on the
outside
street.
Outside of Malo?
Yeah. Outside of Malo.
Now, was he just selling his shirt to buy crack? Because
I had no reason to believe that he would then use the money for drugs. But I don't know.
Are you I mean, you're still proud of that purchase.
I'm very proud of that purchase. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you said that with this sort of tone that's made it sound like impulse purchase. But
he was like, oh my God, you can get that at the Grove. And I was saying, you can get it at 2 a.m. outside of Malo.
Yeah.
You don't have to go to the Grove.
Did he see you and scope you out? He was like, you'll buy it.
No, he didn't scope me. No, he was just kind of walking up and down the street. And I was like, that's sweet. I want to purchase that.
Nerd shirts, get your nerd shirts. Hey, chap.
Maybe.
Equalizers, LEDs.
Yeah, it was more like that.
Want to have a shirt that shows where the Wi-Fi connection is? Sure you do, nerdy. Here you go. And you flip them a coin and you...
Well, that actually... Have you seen the Make magazine, the recent Make magazine? Where is it that has... It shows you how to make a vest that you can wear when biking that shows your speed. I mean...
That's awesome.
That's cool, right? But except completely useless. Yeah. Because, I mean, you don't... You need to know your speed. Other people don't have to.
Right. There would probably be a lot of accidents. Someone trying to look and then not paying attention.
Or it just keeps them to try to pedal much faster than they normally would so that people will think they're really awesome. And it probably cause a lot of accidents.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the end result will always
be the same. But you could probably, I mean, if you're going to build one, you might as well hack your own building thing and just make it like multiply times three. So you're like, I'm going 95 miles an hour.
Exactly.
There actually, in that, I think it's the same issue. There is a thing about... a knitting community, a knitters group in Austin, Texas, who knit a sweater essentially for a whole bus. It's really cool looking. And this is the killer. They're called Knitta Please.
Oh, that's the best name ever.
No, it just made me want to quit everything.
That actually just supplanted my favorite band name, Ted Danson, D-A-N-C-I-N.
That's really good. Well, my favorite band name, which is told to us by a waitress at a Denny's who was in this band, is Bloodbath and Beyond.
Oh, that's really good.
That's really good, isn't it? Tim and I have a side project called Polterchrist.
Polterchrist.
Yeah.
It's not as good as Bloodbath and Beyond, though.
No.
Our friend Dragon Boy Suede has a DJ called DJ Scratchatory Rape.
Yes.
Which is pretty good.
Which is whoever's running the CD player at the
show. Whoever's running the CD. And then there's another one who's DJ Tanner.
DJ Tanner, yeah.
There's a crepe restaurant called Date Crepe.
Dave Crepe.
There's a new crepe truck called Creping Around.
Really? Where?
Wow. It's just around Silver Lake.
One of those crepe trucks you see everywhere.
Well, there's like two of them now.
You guys could do a whole separate podcast about bad puns or good puns, as the case may be.
Well, just puns.
Yeah. I suppose there is no scale of quality for puns.
No.
It's just, it is or is not.
Yeah, that's true.
Total binary quality.
Were you guys, and then we'll wrap it up in a second because we've just about exhausted your time, but you guys must be big comedy fans, I would assume, because you're funny guys, and I assume you like comedy.
I like funny stuff.
I'm a little bit more of the comedy.
Tim knows names and stuff.
What comics do you like?
Well, Phil Hartman is my favorite, like, sketch comedy.
Yeah.
Was my favorite sketch comedy actor.
Oh, man.
He could still be your favorite. Yeah. He just doesn't do anything.
Well, not
he decomposes.
My fave currently, I can't remember his name right now. He died heroin overdose.
Mitch Hedberg.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I think, wasn't it cocaine?
Oh, we'll see. This is how little I know.
Let's not get into the details. It's sad either way.
It is sad.
Did you bring those police reports with you, or did you forget
right
those
here.
Again?
Every comedian that's died in the last 30 years.
Wow. Why do you carry those around?
Thanks, smoking gun.
For moments like this. Yeah, exactly. I'm sure you could go on Smoking Gun and actually see the death certificate. But you guys were super nice, and I really appreciate you letting us come into your house.
Thanks.
Like this. And by the way, your dogs are awesome.
They are awesome.
Anyone can see Damien's dogs.
Well, everybody can see my dogs because they're also the founder and CEO of our new record company. Our announcement of the new record company it was made with them, and then we actually have we recorded a business meeting with them also last week, and so there's sort of a growing series of our internal business workings.
So are you not with EMI anymore? Did you branch?
No,
out?
We broke away from EMI a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago.
Congratulations!
Thank you.
That must feel pretty good. You'll actually get to see the money that you're earning.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is really good. It's great for us in so many ways. I mean, we just are we're at a place where that's not what we particularly need, and we weren't particularly good for them because we don't focus a lot on selling records. We focus on making stuff, and so it's good. It's wonderful. We were like super, super happy.
But I feel like if you know, these big companies were smart, they would look at guys like you and go, hey, they just love to work on cool stuff. Let's kind of develop them over time rather than trying to make some couple $1,000s in the short run. Like, they could have made shitloads of money off you because you obviously will be working for a very long time.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose it depends what business you think you're in, and they're definitely in the business of selling records in the traditional way, and so the metric of success for them is how many copies have sold, and we obviously think in a very different way than that. Distribution systems like record labels that arose to connect the dots. You know, you have like people who make stuff and people who want to see or hear or eat or smell that stuff or whatever. And, you know, in the case of record companies, they really became the only way that you could get stuff to the public. And now that the internet has sort of obviated that, they have to, like, you know, they sort of have to figure out a new way to do business. And, you know, in the 60 years since the record business, you know, sort of got full steam, they actually started providing lots of other services for musicians, like risk aggregation. You know, like most musicians fail, but most musicians also get signed and spend somebody else's money and then fail, and so they don't go back to Starbucks owing the world $500,000 for the tour that failed or something. And promotional services and all. I mean, there's all sorts of things that record labels did, and musicians, especially musicians who have not yet, like, you know, hit solvency, really need that stuff. It's just they can't get it from record labels because record labels don't have any money now.
I feel like the record industry is kind of like, I think of it as a guy who was really hot in the 70s, and now it's just all his nose is destroyed from coke, and he's just fucking sweaty and stringy hair, like gut hanging out of a wrinkled button-up shirt. He's like, the fucking party's not over yet, guys.
The thing is, that's not actually a metaphor. It actually
it actually is.
It's like, it's about two dozen of that guy.
So now that you've started your own record label, I'm sure you want people to come up to you on the street nonstop and hand you CDs.
And cocaine.
CDs and cocaine.
The thing is, he was hot in the 70s doing coke, and now we're hot in the aughts and doing coke. And so we need the coke now so we can be the dying industry in 20 years from now.
Oh, I can't wait.
You know?
It's going to be a sweet ride, you guys.
Yeah, no, I am.
We're going to coast it into our own Roaring Twenties, where we were recording with a robot voice.
Sarsaparilla in the summertime.
All right, so we are going to we're going to end the chatty part of the podcast now, and then I want to play Tim's song that you made, the interview remix. Does it have a specific name, or are you just calling it the interview remix?
I think I'd like to call it A Real Funky Vibe.
A Real Funky Vibe, yeah. The remix for Bulimix. Yeah.
Here's a real funky vibe on Radio Nerdist.
Let's just pop it in and act like we're coming out of the song right now.
Whoa!
Great song, Tim!
Wow!
Well, we're going to cut this part out,
tight.
Though.
Oh, this part?
Yeah, we're not coming in after the song. That's gonna coast us into...
No. We came in after the song, and now we're done.
Wait, no, what?
There were so many smiles made because of that moment.
Yeah. No, but the podcast is going to end with the song.
It just did.
Yeah.
It's over.
Just now.
Yeah, right.
We're done.
Are we on?
Is J.J. Abrams directing this podcast?
What?
That's the Lost logo.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, guys. Right.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You already put out a funky vibe.
Leaving Nerdist.com.